We're in the studio with a guy we call our special correspondent because he's pretty special. He volunteers his time, and we appreciate it. Jim Oliver, this is your show. You're in the spotlight.
Gee, I don't know how I can react to all of this. I've been very grateful for this opportunity to participate in the show. You inherited me, and I'm just flabbergasted that you allowed me to hang around all these years.
Oh, I love it.
It's been great fun. I heard somebody say once that when you're retired, you can do what you want to do rather than what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And these interviews that I do on Spectrum West have been so much fun. To pick out a half a dozen interviews has been really difficult. I did this one mostly for fun,
mm-hmm.
but there are a couple of serious interviews here as well. I have them, most of the script still in my computer at home, so that's basically how I went through and picked these, was just to go through and saw, oh, I remember that one, and then I'd go into the WPR archive and listen to it.
So out of all of your tenure here, which is more impressive than mine, you have picked seven. Who's up first?
Bob Carr from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild.
Okay.
He's one of the founders of the Guild, and I first met and interviewed Bob for Spectrum West in early 2006. We talked then about that year's upcoming 25th anniversary celebration. We also talked about the Guild's acquisition of its new home on Grand Avenue, which became the Grand Theater. He appeared on Spectrum West again on February 5th, 2010, in advance of the Guild's 30th anniversary season and to talk about an upcoming show. He is a retired teacher from the Fall Creek School District and currently the volunteer director of maintenance at the Grand Little Theater, the Theater Guild's home base on First and Grand in Eau Claire. Now, I have to offer you a brief apology here because I always made kind of light of that. And then last fall, I had occasion to be in the lower level of the Grand Little Theater and found this door that had a plate on it that said something to the effect, Bob Carr, Director of Maintenance. Yes, and there's a little plate below it that says Gary Polden, Assistant Director. Gary is a talented musician, and I think it's very honorable that he...
But not as talented a cleaner as am I.
Is that right?
That's
okay.
Why he's assistant.
Aha, okay. Anyway, it's nice to know we've got that cleared up. This is really a legitimate
position.
I'll let
you know we have the cleanest toilets on Grand Avenue. That's a good one.
Well, that's interesting to know. His current project is directing the Theater Guild's upcoming production of Midlife, the Crisis musical, which, and I don't know where to put the emphasis on that. It says Midlife, ! The Crisis musical. Now, I'm not sure where the emphasis falls.
Well, it depends on what stage of midlife you're in. Okay. If it's just midlife beginning where you just forget your keys, that's one thing. But if it's to the point of where you're walking in a room and you don't know why you're there and you have to go in for your proctoscope.
Well, anyway.
Or the kids move back to the house, then it really becomes
that's,
a crisis.
That's the crisis. I can tell that from experience. But anyway, it runs from February 11th through the 20th at the Grand Little Theater. You know, Bob Carr, you can tell already, has joined us to talk about Midlife, the Crisis musical, and perhaps some other things we can wring out of him about the Guild's upcoming 30th season. So, Mr. Carr, we certainly appreciate your coming over. Tell us about Midlife, the Crisis musical.
Well, I had heard about it about 2 years ago, and I started reading, and I thought, okay, this is one, if I can remember, I want to direct. There's so many shows now about various ages and the problems they go with. And I came across, and okay, this encompasses the problems that all sexes and children and grandchildren experience when somebody's going through midlife. And it's very funny. As I alluded to before, we all have the tendency to walk into a room and stop and try to remember why we're there, or we're always searching for the set of car keys, or you're trying to get the kids out of the house. I mean, like moving away, various medical issues that arrive. And it's all arisen, it's all looked at very, very comical point of view, perspective.
Well, tell us who's in the cast.
Just before we went on, he said, now I'm going to ask you who's in the cast. I go, yipes! We got six big names that I've worked with for 30 years. But Gary Polden, my assistant, janitor, but he's a much better musician than actor. Really a neat guy. Pat McGinnis, people may know him as a coach from Memorial, who is a really good singer and a really, really, really funny, funny man. Steve Bohr, who's been in a lot of our shows. Sandy Patton, who is an audience favorite. Laura Leese, again, who has been with us since the beginning, and one of our directors who is performing for either the first or second time since she moved to Eau Claire, Gloria Font.
Well, let's move on to the 30th anniversary stuff. Tell us about how the Theater Guild got started.
We're working on this anniversary, and my Lord, that's 30 years of my life I'm talking about. How did it happen so fast? And then we drag out the old slides, the old pictures. I think, my Lord, who's that darn good looking young buck there. And I know who it is, and it is I.
Oh, I was going to say it's not you, but yeah, anyway.
But anyway, 30 years, longer ago than that, about 32, 33 years ago, a group of us, as many were in those days, talking about wanting to have an outlet for the adult community as far as theater goes, because there wasn't anything. And so three or four of us spent a year in preparation by going to various conferences, conventions, talking to people who had theaters that had existed for a while, how they got started, what they would do differently, were they to start all over again, and various other things that relate to forming that type of organization. Then we went public. And at our first meeting, there were maybe 25, 30 people that showed up for that meeting at the Parks and Rec, and they said, go ahead, and we passed a hat and ended up with a $60 budget. And the rest is history, as they say. Actually, I think something that should be mentioned that we've not mentioned before. In that first year, obviously, you know, we were trying to get started. We didn't have much money and a lot of these things, and went to the city council. And no matter what you think about local politics, the city council gave us $3,000 startup money. Wow. And they said it's a one-time only gift, because in those days they hadn't started giving to all the arts organizations. And I think that's something we neglect to, you know, to mention when we start talking about this organization and its success. The city really did fund us that first year.
You've had all these jobs. You've been a director and not a director, and you've been an actor and a member of the board of directors and all of this stuff, and you're still very dedicated, and this volunteer stuff, which I make fun of, but it's very literally an important thing that you do. How have you managed to hang in there? What drives you to do that?
Well, remember, 30 years ago, it was, the 70s and so forth, and I didn't do drugs, so I wasn't addicted to anything. And I didn't drink very much, so what else was I going to do? Actually, I just have a passion for it. Mm-hmm. I have a passion for the theater, and all of my students will tell you that no matter what I taught, theater was an integral part of it. But I also have a passion for my community. And it was just, there's no question that once I made this commitment, that I was going to see it through.
I rarely get to interview musicians on Spectrum West. I'm not a musician, and our host, Al Ross, is. But in early 2010, Al was having and recovering from surgery. And singer and guitarist Leon Redbone was scheduled to play a twin bill with guitarist Leo Kottke at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Leon Redbone was an interesting and entertaining guest, although he revealed very little of himself. You have become known for faithful interpretations of long-forgotten music. So tell us how you select your music and how do you develop your interpretations?
Well, that's a sad statement, I must say, because that implies that the music of the past is no longer of any use to anybody, which is really unfortunate, especially from my point of view.
Well, that's, I suppose, because, I did read an interview where you said that you still maintain that most of the great sounds captured come from the 1920s and a little later, but certainly not recently. So why do you suppose that is?
I was in a particularly overactive curmudgeon point of view there, but I could be correct.
So how do you select your music?
I have no idea. I've heard these things over the years, and I don't keep coming up with new tunes necessarily, but I try and remember some of the ones that I liked, and occasionally I put that across. But there's no particular thinking. I'm not really that organized about this whole thing. It's just my preference. It's always been that way, and I'll probably remain so.
Are there any particular songwriters or musicians who you like or to do their work?
I think it's a combination of the two, because you can have the best songwriter in the world, but if you don't have people who can actually put the song across somehow, it doesn't really work. So that's the most fascinating thing about the early entertainers and recording artists, is the ones that you are more likely to gravitate to are the ones who can really put a song across, which is something that hasn't had any great importance, I think, in the last few decades. It's just more to do with personality than it has to do with the actual song and the sentiment expressed in the song.
Can you give us an idea of what some of the songs might be that you'll be performing when you come to Eau Claire?
I'd be happy to if I had any idea, but unfortunately I don't know what I'm doing from one moment to the next. So it's a collection of tunes that may or may not come to mind.
You know, I had the feeling you were going to say that, but I'd ask the question anyway.
I'm trying to be consistent as best as I can.
You're doing very nicely, I'll have to tell
you. Thank you very much.
We're visiting with Leon Redbone, the guitarist and vocalist. You've also done work in movies, television, and commercials. So how did you get started in those areas?
Probably been dragged into it one way or another. I didn't mind doing them because at the time when I was doing some of those commercials, the entire business, of course, folded maybe 20 years ago, or at least 15 or so. Everything changes, and if you're not paying attention, it changes without you realizing that it changed. But if you're involved in it in some way, you're more likely to get an advanced understanding of what actually happened. So in other words, what goes on today is not the same as what was going on 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were in a fairly contemporary movie, as I recall. The movie Elf featured your music.
Well, that was just a phone call that I got, and I don't know how I got that call or why. But the theme itself wasn't a new one. It was just a new approach. That's how that came about. It was just a phone call. I happened to be traveling out west, and I had to make a little detour to Salt Lake City to do a voiceover. And then eventually in Los Angeles to do the rest of it, which is the song with Deschanel.
Is that the way it worked, too, with the TV series Mr. Belvedere, where you did the opening theme?
No, that was a little, that was more, I think that was in New York, and that was more casual. Not that this last one wasn't so casual, but the whole spirit of doing that sort of work back then was quite casual. It just seems quite different now, as does everything else. The last time I was in New York, I was looking for a brownstone, and I realized as I was walking down the road that it's no longer there. So things change, in other words. Mm. Not necessarily for the better.
Now, you were a featured musical artist on Saturday Night in 1975, which apparently kicked off a pretty good sale of your first album. How did you get the Saturday Night gig?
I think the Michael, I believe, the head man, for some reason wanted me to do it. I never really got the opportunity to ask him why, but I guess that would have been a strange question anyway. So
he was interested, and you didn't ask any questions.
So. No, I mean, it wasn't my kind of thing. The production that they had set up was very confusing and distracting. I don't know if I would be able to do that today, quite frankly, because I'm easily distracted.
Now, I purposely avoided asking you anything about your past because everything I've read about you in the past couple of days indicates that you don't want to talk about your past. So why is that?
Well, you know, once you talk about your past, it's really not that interesting.
Oh, okay.
Well, which means that it couldn't have been that interesting anyway. So I try not to dwell on it. My main objective is to sing one song the way it should be sung. And as yet, I haven't reached that level.
Uh-huh. No, I have to say that I did read one piece where you were working, I think, a club in Toronto, and the manager said that they would take you home every night and you would have them drop you off at a different place every night. Is that a true story?
Well, I probably not, because I didn't have a home.
Oh. Well, okay.
No, those are interesting little lines. Somebody's idea of presenting an interesting something to say.
I thought it was amusing, but it was maybe not interesting, but it was
amusing. No, it was amusing. Amusing is good. Yes,
I
said corrected.
Yeah, I think it was Rolling Stone or something that had published that.
This is one of the reasons why I try and stay focused on what it is that I actually do know, which may be of some interest to anybody. And so that's the reason why I just stayed with talking about what it is that I actually do as opposed to where I eat and that sort of thing.
Mary Logue is a mystery writer, poet, and rug maker. She lives in the Minneapolis suburb of Golden Valley and has a home in the Stockholm, Wisconsin area. She has written 9 novels in the Claire Watkins series, all set in Pepin County. She made one of her Spectrum West appearances on October 22, 2010, to talk about the 8th in the Watkins series, Frozen Stiff. Ms. Logue, I have enjoyed a sauna or two in my life, but I have never finished off the experience by running outside in sub-zero weather and rolling in the snow.
But you do know that people do that, don't
Yes,
you?
I know. It's just perfectly appropriate. They do it in their birthday suit, as I recall. But after reading Frozen Stiff, I doubt that I ever will do that. So with that bit of an introduction, will you tell us what Frozen Stiff is all about?
One of the first decisions I often make when I'm starting a new mystery is, what time of year will it be? I like to really pull things into my books that are very typical of the Midwestern life. I started writing this book last year when we were having a very cold winter, and my mind goes in devious places, and I thought, what would happen if it was New Year's Eve and a guy who no one really cared very much about was celebrating in his sauna and went out to roll in the snow and couldn't get back into the house?
Mm. So that's where it all begins. When we read your background, it causes one to wonder, how have you become so familiar with the process of murder investigations?
You know, I grew up with a mom who read every murder mystery she could get her hands on. So I think I started reading them myself at an early age. I do most enjoy the mysteries that are not so puzzly. I like mysteries that are more psychological. I'm really much more interested in why does something happen.
But Claire Watkins was a police detective in Minneapolis, and then she moved to Pepin County with her daughter, and she sounds very believable as a police investigator. Do you do any research into police methods?
Absolutely. The actual sheriff of Pepin County and I are friends, and he has given me the highest compliment possible when he told me a few years ago that his wife loves my books. But he has been very generous with his time and has taken me through the jails, talks to me about questions I have, and really has held my hand a bit. I also have friends that work for the Crime Bureau, but I also do a lot of research on what it's like to live in the country, because I started this series when I bought a house down in Stockholm, and I had a lot to learn about rural life. So I'm often asking my friends, you know, what could a chicken die from, and when are the soybeans actually harvested?
Uh-huh. Have you patterned the character of Claire Watkins after anyone you know?
I often get asked if she's me, you know, and I get that. I understand that. And she's not. I do understand her to a certain extent, but she's kind of more practical than I am. She's a little bit less emotional than I am. I really like her, but she's a little more straight ahead than I am. The person that most closely resembles me in the books are Meg, her daughter. I really have based Meg on my own childhood and what I was like as a kid. So that was kind of fun. But Claire is, you know, she comes out of really more personality aspects that I have noticed in law enforcement people.
I remember the TV series Murder, She Wrote, where Jessica Fletcher solved a murder mystery a week in a small town of Cabot Cove, Maine. And eventually it was determined that Jessica needed to expand her influence. Will that ever happen to Claire Watkins, whose arrival in Pepin County, Wisconsin, has been followed by a series of killings in that rural area?
Well, I'll tell you, it has been a real concern of mine. When I started writing this series, there hadn't been a murder in Pepin County in 22 years. And unfortunately, I have to say that a couple of years after I killed off the first person fictionally in Pepin County, we did have a murder investigation that I will admit I followed very closely.
You wrote on your webpage that poetry is the foundation of your work. Talk about how that ties in with your mystery novels.
One of the things that I love about writing about this area in Pepin County is that I'm in love with it. And I think that I tend to write lyrically about the landscape. I love the bluff country. I love the Mississippi. And I love the seasons. I'm very, very aware of what flowers are blooming when. And I think that really fills out my novel, that when you read a Claire Watkins mystery, you're not just any place. You are specific historically in Pepin County along the river there. But my mystery writing also informs my poetry in that lovely twist at the end of a mystery where you think you know where you're headed and then, vump, all of a sudden you're aimed in a different direction. I think that has carried over into my poetry writing, that I write what appear to be kind of often simple poems and then twirl at the end and you end up faced in a different direction.
Well, we mentioned at the beginning that you also make rugs, and you have some posted on your webpage, and they're really lovely pieces, and I'm sure they're even much more beautiful in person.
Thank you. Tell us
what is rug hooking?
Well, about 15 years ago, a wonderful woman, Marianne Wise, just outside of Stockholm, Wisconsin, she's a fiber artist, and she decided to teach a bunch of her neighbors how to rug hook, which is taking salvaged wool strips, cut up wool strips, and pulling them through a foundation fabric and making a design. And I just took to it. I'd often done handwork growing up. I had embroidered. I'd done some sewing. I did a little quilting. But when I started rug hooking, it seemed to really suit my slightly limited artistic ability. A primitive design is really fun on a rug. And I just loved watching the picture begin to emerge from these scraps of wool. And there was something so tactile and so different. It was a nice pairing with my writing. So during the day, I write. And at night, I rug hook.
Do you exhibit your work?
Yes, I do. I do. I've had a show of my own up in the Twin Cities. And then I've been in a number of shows around the country even. And I've had rugs in a couple books. It's so much fun.
Mary Logue has since published another in the Claire Watkins series, Lake of Tears, and has two books in a new series about a librarian, Karen Nash, under the pen name of Mary Lou Kerwin.
This is a special New Year's edition of Spectrum West, the Jim Oliver Conversations. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Details, offering unique apparel, jewelry, and scarves in the historic Water Street District of Eau Claire for 29 years. Details is located at 502 Water Street or online at detailsdirect.com.
The Latecomer, a Hmong family memoir, was written by Keo Kalia Yang, a Hmong writer from St. Paul. In the fall of 2010, she was an artist in residence in the English department at UW-Eau Claire and was a presenter at that fall's Chippewa Valley Book Festival. Keo Kalia Yang appeared on Spectrum West on October 15th, 2010. Before we get into the Hmong experience and the culture that you so vividly describe, tell us how you crafted your memoir.
The memoir began as a love letter to my grandma. My grandma promised me that she'd never die, because the Mbanbinai refugee camp, the place where I was born, suicide was the number one cause of death, and everybody killed themselves around my birthday. I'm a December baby, and so I'd wake up, and a lot of people would be dying, and I could hear the cries of the dead the morning coming through our doors. And my grandma promised me that she would never die. In America, 2003, her paperwork say that she's 93. I'm a senior at Carleton College, and graduation is only months away. And my grandma falls down in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, and she can't get up again. She says that there were people who loved her before me, that before me she had a mom and a dad and brothers and sisters, and that somewhere in time they were all waiting for her. Because there is no place in the map of the world with Hmong land on it that she was going to climb the mountain in her heart, go back to the house of her youth, and everybody'd say, "Where have you been? Why are you so late in coming home?" The book emerges because nobody knew that my grandma was dying. My heart was breaking, but spring was coming, and the air was warming up, and the sun was shining. And I could feel the wind blow against me, and I felt so hollow in the world. And so I started writing a long love letter to her, like I did as a kid when she lived in California. I wrote the back of the book before I wrote the front of the book. It was very personal, very intimate, because it was just a love letter to my grandma. There were no secrets that she didn't know about the life we shared.
One reviewer wrote that this is the best account of the Hmong experience I've ever read. Powerful, heartbreaking, and unforgettable. Now, I haven't read that many books on the Hmong experience, but I can agree with most of that. It was certainly heartbreaking in the early going. Much of the early part of the book was set in a time before you were born or shortly thereafter. Talk about how those early chapters were researched.
That reviewer is Ann Fadiman, who wrote The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. And I want to acknowledge that in so many ways my work and my journey into writing has been shaped by her phenomenal work in her book in introducing the Hmong to a literary America. My own journey into the writing of the book, because I wrote the back first, the back was almost present tense. A lot of the stories in the book were told to me throughout my life, not because I was writing a book, but because all the adults wanted to make sure that I wouldn't forget. Because I come from an oral tradition, language must be able to write on the fabric of memory, spoken language. And so there's this keen sensitivity to language. But the thing about memoirs is that it is true we have our memories, but we also have the memories passed down to us by those who've come before. And we all live in the memories of a bigger world. So the research, the work that I had to do before December 17, 1980, were found in books, were found in the stories and the memories passed down to me, in the images and the pictures that I could access. Because Columbia has a great library. So in the writing of the book, I spent 2.5 years reading pretty much everything that had been written in English on the Hmong experience. Because the book is nonfiction and my name will be on it. And I knew that it would be one of the first literary works to be published in America by a Hmong writer.
Now, your book indicates that you got off to kind of a slow start in the public school system, but then you tell about a teacher who encouraged your writing.
Mrs. Gallatin, 9th grade, Harding High School, East Side of St. Paul. She taught English pre-IB, and I was one of the kids in the class, and I never talked, but I wrote for her. One of my first essays is in response to the question, is the story of Romeo or Juliet, and Romeo and Juliet, a story of love and lust? After I submitted the essay to her, feeling very much that I could be wrong, that everything I had on the page wasn't right, she said to me that I'd written more than an answer to a question, that I had spoken to how questions come from life and must end in life. Mrs. Gallatin made me see the possibility of me as a writer, because I didn't talk for most of my life. So on the page, I could go to the places I couldn't in real life. You know, in English, when I speak, I'm always doing CPR to the language. On the page, a different facility grew.
Now, spirituality plays a continuing role throughout your book. The designated guide at your grandmother's funeral offered directions for her afterlife journey to her beginnings. Do you expect to return to your beginnings when the time comes?
That's a lovely question. I am the granddaughter of 4 shamans on both sides. They were all medicine people. They were all healers. Came to America thinking, growing up, that one day I would become a doctor, because it was what my community needed. Like generations before, and like those generations who will come after us, we always think we need doctors. But today I am a writer, and I said to my dad, kind of flippantly, that what I wanted to do with words was the same thing that my grandparents had done with medicine, that I want to use it to heal. And you know, as I've aged, the flippancy has wavered and vanished, and it becomes the standard for the work that I must do. My grandma always taught me that there was nothing to fear if I was with people who had faith. She said that in the dark, I could call Grandpa to help me. I could call the Dalai Lama if I wanted, Jesus, God, Buddha, all of these entities would protect what is good in me. I've always been entirely comfortable with different ideas of believing, different approaches to spirituality. But for myself, when I think to that day, in the Hmong culture, we say when you reach 120. When I reach 120 years old, I would love to travel the roads that my ancestors have before me. I would love to wander through the different places that have held my spirit safe. This journey that we call life, I want to say thank you. I want to say goodbye. I want to go back to a house where everybody who loved me be waiting with dinner on the table, low to the ground.
Do you believe in heaven?
Well, I'm marrying a Caucasian man, and his parents are Lutheran ministers. And so the question of heaven is an interesting one. I believe that there is such a place for the people who want to go there. I believe that it is a space that could heal, you know, the hurt of life. I believe that. But I'm going to go to my ancestral home so I could see my grandma again.
Jim and Jane Jeffries of Eau Claire are a pair of educators who have established a nearly 20-year-old family business called Jest Scripts. They write madrigal plays and market them on the internet. They also write conventional plays that they sell through conventional publishers. They first appeared on Spectrum West on December 9th, 2011. Jeffries join us today to talk about Christmas present and perhaps share their secret for coexisting in an artistic endeavor where egos often get in the way. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thanks.
Well, let's start first of all. Let's get this out of the way. Tell us what Christmas present is about.
We take a look at Bible stories, and because they're in the Bible, we never really take a look at how really strange they are. I mean, if you take a look at the Nativity story, if you've got Zechariah and Elizabeth, you've got a woman in her 70s or 80s who's pregnant. And we read that and don't think anything of it because we're used to it. You know, and we imagine what would happen if all this happened today and we put it in a modern context. So, you know, Elizabeth, who's 76 and pregnant, is in an assisted living facility. And when she goes into labor, you can imagine some interesting reactions are going to happen. We've got the wise men who are businessmen from the East who are looking for the one. They're expecting some big businessman instead of a little baby. We've got Shepherd's, which is a fast food restaurant which specializes in shepherd's pies that the angels come and visit through the drive-thru. And we've got the innkeeper's tale because, you know, the innkeeper, let's face it, gets a bad rap. Everybody looks at him and says, you put him in the stable out back? But this is during a census. I mean, the place is packed. The guy was really pretty generous. I mean, he rented out his own room. And so we try to recreate that with the Star Trek convention going on at the hotel so they don't have room for Mary and Joseph.
So who's in the cast?
We have about probably 48 or 50 in the cast.
Oh, really? Oh, just give me some of the principal characters then.
Well, we could start with the three wise guys, our wise men. But there are three CEOs from the East. And so we have Jane LaPointe Kilgallen. She's Demur. And we have Brad Henderson. He's Harry Gold. Ken Walden is Frank Incense.
So the names are Frank Incense, Gold, and Demur.
Okay.
I know, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that out loud.
Well, maybe you spoiled the whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, I've been reading up on you folks, and it's terribly interesting stuff to me. How did you get started writing plays or madrigals? Which came first, by the way, the madrigals or the plays?
The madrigals came first.
Oh, okay.
I was teaching at Eau Claire Christian High School. It was a small school in town, and they didn't really have any money a lot of times. And so they had a madrigal dinner, and our choir teacher left, so I took it over and sort of turned it into what we called a medieval dinner instead. We'd order our plays from a guy in Minnesota, and they were fun, but I had a lot of students in the cast, so we would always write side bits so that we had enough roles for all of the students. So over time, we thought, huh, everybody's laughing. I think we can do just as well. Why don't we just try to write our own?
And they were laughing at the right spots, too, which, you know, was interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got our start. Mm-hmm.
So that was in 1995. So then you started writing plays, or which one of you started writing the play, or do you do those together as well?
Oh, we do those together as well. It sort of evolved where we had a madrigal play that didn't really work as a madrigal play. And so my wife sent it in on a lark to a publishing company, and you know, they accepted it the first time. You're supposed to pay your dues before you're published.
I think we
were just too stupid to fail. You've got companies that are too big to fail. We were too stupid to fail, and we just figure stupidity is the best policy, and we've been going that way ever since.
Why don't you describe what is the difference between a madrigal and a play, then?
Madrigal dinner, they have several of those in town. You know, a Renaissance theme. Usually the focus is on the singers itself. So like Memorial High School and the university both have one. But they also have a, you know, sort of a set outline through the evening with the wassail and bringing in the boar's head and everything. And then they have a show at the end. It's a comedy. We just started writing those after, you know, we were working at my school. And so then we thought, well, it's the internet world. Let's put up a website and see if we can sell them. So we did.
And we were sort of lucky in that we were able to test out some of our plays at the Renaissance Festival. And what's great about a Renaissance Festival, if they don't like your play, they will leave, as we know, in droves. So we found out which parts were sort of slow moving by the audience, you know, dwindling down to one. So we learned to make them really fast paced in order to keep the audience.
He is Jim and she is Jane. They're the Jeffries. How do you divide the writing? How does this all work?
Well, this is the way it works. I'm responsible for personally crafting with loving care each joke, each pun, and each bit of slapstick humor. Jane takes care of the rest of the unimportant stuff like plot, character development, making sure the play makes sense. Uh-huh. And that's been working for us for quite some time.
So, Jane, that's why you're the president and he isn't. Is that the story?
Let's go with that. Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Okay. Now, you have a daughter who's involved as well.
She does everything I used to do. I was just a lackey, and now I'm the senior lackey, now that my daughter is junior lackey. And she takes care of organizing the plays and getting them off to the customers. And she's also written for plays so far. Usually inheriting our sense of humor is a handicap that sort of prevents you from fitting into society. But she's found a way to make it work for her.
That's certainly encouraging for her, I'm sure. Talk a little bit about your business, for want of a better term. You have a web page and you market your madrigals, also your plays too, online?
Well, the plays we sell through other publishers.
So they do the marketing for us.
So they do the marketing for us. The madrigals, medieval dinners, we sell. And what's great about the internet age is you just put a website up and people beat a path to your door. I mean, that's been just great.
Google Madrigal Dinners, and there aren't that many people out there writing Madrigal Dinners. So.
Not that we want any more people writing Madrigal Dinners. We think the market is saturated, and it's not a very good opportunity for the enterprising businessman.
Well, do you have a strategy? I noticed that you, in some of your advanced publicity, you were talking about the fact that you were really bummed out about only having been produced in 40 states.
Ten states, for some reason. I mean, what is up with Hawaii? I mean, I think if we have a magical dinner involving grass skirts, I think we could open up that market. And it's weird, it sort of makes a belt across the United States.
Yeah, we didn't get Kentucky yet, right?
We haven't gotten Kentucky yet.
It's just kind of irritating when we're from Indiana. But
They see we're from Indiana, and that's why
there's always some rivalries going on.
A little bit of rivalry. Yeah.
You're listening to a special New Year's edition of Spectrum West, the Jim Oliver Conversations. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Mayo Clinic Health System, bringing Mayo Clinic care to communities throughout western Wisconsin. Dedicated to providing high-quality health care close to home. Details are at mayoclinichealthsystem.org.
The Old Gem Theater of New Richmond is a wonderful resource for schools in the area that like to expose their students to children's stories of all varieties. One of the most serious topics came in the play about the Holocaust, I Never Saw Another Butterfly. Kathy Welch, the Old Gem's artistic director, talked about the play on March 1st, 2012.
I Never Saw Another Butterfly is originally a book that was put together. The Terezin, which was a Jewish ghetto in the Czech Republic, housed a lot of children. Over 15,000 children went through the gates of Terezin during the course of the Holocaust. And several of the women there decided to try and keep the kids' spirits up and keep the spirit of learning and the love of the arts alive by conducting classes. And they would have the children write poems and do paintings and things like that. And I Never Saw Another Butterfly is a collection of some of the paintings and poems that were written by the children that had survived, were hidden from the Nazis and survived. And then the play, I Never Saw Another Butterfly, is inspired by those paintings and the poetry from that book.
Now, who wrote the play?
The play is by Celeste Risponti, and she had done a lot of research talking to a few of the survivors from Terezin in putting together the play.
Now, it's a one-act play, is that right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah. So why did you select it for this time of the year?
We have found that there's a number of teachers that study World War II and the Holocaust at this time of year, and a lot of the shows that we do here at the Old Gem Theater are specifically for schools that come to the theater for their field trips, and we like to align our shows with the curriculum of the schools. And so it's nice to do something that fits that World War II theme, or else having to do with the the Holocaust because the kids are studying it, and then they get to see something on stage that reflects what they're learning in the classroom.
Now, this is based on the book. So how is the play staged with just a collection of, based on a collection of writings and paintings? How does the play stage?
Yeah, sure. There's a main character, Raja Inglandarova, who was an actual survivor from Terezin, and it's sort of a memory play through her eyes. So we see her as a woman who has maybe 10 years or so after the incident, after the war, remembering both her family life before the war and then what happened to her when she went, what was in Terezin. And the focus is on the classroom and the learning that the children went through.
Now, this the cast includes members of your youth ensemble as well as your adult adult company.
Mm-hmm.
So how many people in the cast?
There's, I'm going to have to think, let's see, we've got 6 young actors and 2 adult actors, so
I see.
8 total.
Okay. How long does the show run?
We're offering it to schools through March 22nd.
How long is the performance?
Oh, it's about an hour long, and then during the public performances we take an intermission. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit about the school groups that attend, and do you do anything in anything special in addition to just doing the play?
We offer Q&A sessions with the cast, especially when we do these serious, more hard-hitting plays. Sometimes it really helps both the students and the young actors as well to have time to kind of digest the play. So after they see it, oftentimes we'll have the cast come out and talk to the students, answer any questions they have, talk about the process that they've gone through in creating the characters and getting the play up on stage.
She is Kathy Welch, who is Artistic Director of the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond and Director of I Never Saw Another Butterfly. Getting to the general topic of the Old Gem Theater, do you write some of the material that's presented there?
I do. I not this one, obviously, but oftentimes we do shows. In fact, we just closed Stone Soup, which was our January show geared for the younger set of elementary school, preschool students. Every year we take some sort of famous fairy tale, folk tale type story, and I usually do the adaptations for those, turn them into an audience participation play for the younger kids.
Now, the Old Gem reputation is pretty much as a children's theater. Do you do shows for older folk as well?
We do. We mix it up. We do comedy nights. We have a lot of guest artists come through to do comedy nights or sometimes music nights. We've got a rock and roll review coming up later in March that the White Sidewalls are going to be bringing to us to show for the adult audiences here at the Old Gem.
Well, let's talk about you a little bit. You earned your PhD in theater from the University of Hawaii. That sounds like a terrible place to go to school.
I did. It was awful.
But anyway, what brought you to New Richmond?
Both my husband and I are originally from the Twin Cities area. We grew up and went to the University of Minnesota. And so this is home. This is where our family is. And so when we finished up all that graduate school, looking at the country, deciding where we wanted to live, we wanted to come home, both for the family and the quality of life, as well as the amount of culture and theater and arts that are available in this area, in the Twin Cities area. And we had moved back and started doing a little bit of theater in the Twin Cities and got word that there was this really nice little theater in New Richmond, Wisconsin that was for sale. So we took a trip on out and took a look at it and fell in love and have been here 11 years now.
Wow, so I guess you found a home. Huh?
Yeah.
Did you, when you were going to school in theater, were you intending to be the owner of a theater someday, or did you want to act or direct professionally, or how did that go?
I got into theater initially because I was attracted to the backstage things. I really loved stage management and scene design and all that sort of thing, and the more I studied, I started directing and kind of found my home in the world of directing. So I went through and got my PhD with an eye towards maybe teaching, maybe at the university, but in a situation where I could direct as well, because that was really my favorite thing to do. And then when this opportunity presented itself, like, hey, I could direct all the time. I don't have to do that teaching stuff, which is ironic because I teach all the time. We have all these classes at the theater.
Yeah, I noticed that you are listed as one of the actors in the adult ensemble. So you do some acting, do you?
I do. I generally steer away from that when I'm directing a show. It's really difficult to direct and act. I find it difficult to do both.
The next time I spoke to Kathy, I asked her about the reaction of schoolchildren to a topic as serious as the Holocaust. She said that usually Holocaust plays are performed for older students who may be studying the topic in school. But in this production, there were some third and fourth graders there. In one scene, a Nazi guard reads a list of children who have perished. During the talk back after the show, one little fourth grader asked, "What does perish mean?" And when the children were told that it meant the children had died, it was a very poignant moment in the theater. On April 6, 2012, Ellie Mason Johnson, the artistic director at the St. Croix Art Barn in Osceola, appeared on Spectrum West and talked about her mission to improve the image of the much maligned Scandinavian couple, Oli and Lena. She had written and played the lead in the play, Oli's Dead, Lena's Dating. Why did you decide to pick on the poor, abused Scandinavian couple once again?
Well, I'm glad you're asking me that, because I think that is... I think that's what Oli and Lena are, is they're an abused Scandinavian couple. And there are lots of jokes, of course, about Oli and Lena. And I've seen a few productions of Oli and Lena's stories. And they really make Scandinavians really not just silly, but a little bit stupid. Mm-hmm. And I saw one last year in the Twin Cities, by a professional theater group, and I was with a group of church people that we had gone and anticipated a nice performance. But when we got back in our van, everybody said, "Ellen, why don't you write something about Oli and Lena, because we know you can do it better without making them so stupid." So that was my motivation. I said, okay. So I started kicking around ideas, and I came up with this.
Tell us what this story is about, then.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a little bit autobiographical in the sense that in two ways. Number one, my mother was a very young widow. My father had died when my mom was only 42. And so I have that experience of knowing what it was like for my mother to be so young and to have lost her husband. And the other way that it's autobiographical is that I have been married to my husband, Neil, for 35 years. We celebrated last year. And so I know what it's like to be in a long-term marriage relationship. So I pulled from both of those experiences, and that's how I came up with Oli's Dead, Lena's Dating.
Uh-huh. So I assume that Oli's been dead for a while if Lena's already dating.
Actually, the play takes place over a number of years. And so poor Oli suffers an accident early in the play. And so Oli doesn't even appear. The play surrounds three women who tell the story of what happens to Lena and her community in Norwegian Valley over a course of years.
You said three women. Now, as I remember the last time we spoke, which was about a year ago, you had written a play called Pause, which you said was for mature women. Is this another play for mature women?
Writers, we have to write from our own experience. And so we actually have the same. I have the two women that were my buddies in Pause, Vicki Harmon from in her real life, she's an educator with the WITC Early Childhood Program in New Richmond. And then Lynn Steiner, who is, I was just looking up a little autobiography on her. I've known her for years. She is considered the Upper Midwest best-known garden writer in her real life. But she comes back to me again, and the three of us teamed up to do this, to have some fun with Oli and Lena.
She is Ellie Mason Johnson, who is a playwright, director, and an actor in the production of Oli's Dead, Lena's Dating. As I recall from our previous conversation last year, you've been writing for over 40 years. So talk a little bit about how your writing has evolved over that time.
Well, I always, as I mentioned before, I always write from my own experience, from places that I've been and people that I've known. They're probably an exaggeration. I pride myself in having a sense of humor. So I write for children, which I enjoy. I like to talk about the environment. I like to talk about social issues. And I guess at this point in my life, I'm most interested in writing about women's experience. One thing that I read a lot of plays, and it's very difficult to find work for mature women, especially in the quantity of more than one. You can find pieces of work where there's a mature woman, but it's usually one part. And usually the story isn't about that woman. I still think that, in fact, Lena, who I play in this upcoming production, tells her friend, she's not a young woman anymore, but she still has a lot of life left in her. And so my writing now is about what that life is, what that life is that we have as women and as we mature, and unfortunately as our husbands die off, what the challenges we face.
You know, that reminds me that the last time we spoke, I asked that, you know, had you considered writing plays for mature men, and you seemed agreeable to the idea, but now it's beginning to sound like you're probably not going to do that.
Well, you know, I don't. The only mature man that I have a lot of experience with is my husband. I don't know that he'd appreciate it. And plus, I don't know all your secrets. We women have things that we share. I'm not sure that I would be good at that. But the other challenge is, especially at the community theater level, is that we have a far more majority of women that are interested and available to be on the stage than we do men. And so it's hard at the Art Barn, for example, to do a play with a lot of men because we just can't seem to get them to come out.
This is a special New Year's edition of Spectrum West, the Jim Oliver Conversations.
So that is our program, and Jim, thanks so much for picking 7 of the memorable interviews you've done. You've done this program a lot longer than I have. Congratulations, and again, I can't thank you enough. You're a wonderful addition to Spectrum West.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.